Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are going to be talking about a host of subjects in which it's clear our polity, our country, is under assault. We're doing so on a day in which we memorialize a terrible attack upon our nation at Pearl Harbor 81 years ago. And it's a reminder that enemies foreign, as well as enemies domestic, can be real threats to our country. And it's a time that I'm very pleased to say we're going to be joined by our duty resident genius. His name is George Raisley, a Mensa member. He is an extraordinarily accomplished public servant in Congress, in the executive branch, as well as a practitioner of the lost art of politics, lost in the sense of honorable, free, and fair elections and the like. And we're going to be talking with George, among other things, about the just completed runoff election in Georgia. But just a word further introduction, George is the editor-in-chief of a terrific online newsletter by Richard Viguerie entitled Conservative HQ. We prize our visits with him. Always delighted to welcome back. George, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you, Frank, for having me.
So let's start with a discussion, George, about election integrity as we have witnessed it in the 2022 cycle, now completed with the election of Senator Warnock as the incumbent, now for a full six-year term, defeating Herschel Walker, his challenger, very narrowly, less than 1%. George, was this a free and fair election, would you say?
Well, I would say it's a little too early to tell on that, Frank. We don't. I haven't seen county by county numbers yet, and so we don't know if any of the oddities, for lack of a better term, that happened in Georgia, irregularities that happened in Georgia in 2020 were repeated. I haven't seen any stories about imaginary water main bursts and things like that. So I think we're dealing here with
no comprehensive failure of tabulating machines in certain Republican precincts, I take it.
Exactly. And so I think what we're dealing with in Georgia, as much as anything, is an institutional problem in how we run elections now. With these, we no longer have election day, we have election month or election 6 weeks in some states. And the whole...
And what are the implications of that, George? Because it's something that is obviously represented as a convenience for voters and something that enables more of them to participate in the election process. But as a practical matter, what does it do?
Well, what it does, Frank, is these massive universal mail-in ballots and things like that institutionalize what would have been considered illegality just a few years ago. And so ballot harvesting, the paid collection of ballots, has really changed the dynamic of how elections are conducted. And so...
And the more time that one has to engage in irregularities, shall we say, chicanery, election fraud, these opportunities obviously are therefore more exploitable.
Yeah.
And to the extent that that's happening... not just in places like Georgia, but across the country, George, is it irredeemably broken, this election process of ours?
Well, it's irredeemably broken in the sense that integrity of elections in terms of one man, one vote, or one woman, one vote, is now always in question. We don't know, for example, when 100 mail-in ballots are dropped off at an apartment building where only 50 people live, what happens to those 50 ballots that are sent there without a valid recipient. So that's where this...
let alone a live one, let alone one who is entitled to vote and all those kinds of considerations.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're flooding the zone, in effect, with potentially fraudulent ballots. And in some places, as you say, there are things like ballot harvesting that allow people to actually collect these kinds of ballots and pass them off as all legitimate. No?
Yeah. And so, you know, if you send 100 ballots to some place where 50 people live and 100 votes come in, once those 50 that can't be assigned to a legal valid voter are in the pool is poisoned. There's no way to pull them back out.
And people are disenfranchised. The legal voters have those illegally cast ballots offsetting theirs. George, this brings me to Arizona, where it seems as though irregularities, shall we say, including complete failure of large numbers of those electronic devices used for ballot casting or tabulation, crapped out. Interestingly enough, predominantly Republican precincts in Maricopa County. And yet we were told there was nothing to see here, folks. I can only imagine if that had been Philadelphia or Detroit or any other city in the country, this would have been, above the fold news
downtown
for days
Atlanta.
And days. Yeah, Atlanta, exactly.
Well,
so what do you make of Arizona?
Well, the Arizona thing is a different situation, and it really brings into question the use of these electronic voting machines, because my take is that there was a planned attack on the system there to, in essence, modulate the number of Republican votes that would come in. And so
on election day,
when
Republicans tend to vote disproportionately.
Exactly.
Right?
And so if you can either in reality or in imagination say, oh, my goodness, the printer's down, whether it's down or not, you can, in essence, modulate how many people are coming through those doors. You can have it down for an hour. And you know that will cut down a certain number of votes.
It will indeed. George, as we speak, the United States Senate is, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear a case in which the contention is that when the framers of the Constitution said that state legislatures will make the rules regarding timing and other arrangements for elections, what they really meant to say was all of government will have that responsibility. How do you think this is likely to sort out?
Well, interesting question, Frank. I am not real confident that the plain meaning of the Constitution will prevail in this case.
Really? Wow. I mean, even with the conservative court at the moment?
Yeah, even with the conservative court. I look at the Constitution and think that the founders, the drafters of the Constitution, meant what they said when they wrote it. And so
not the opposite, in fact.
Yeah.
And, George, we have to take a short break, but this is why we value you. You know, you bring genius to what is basically just common sense. And it's always very bracing to have somebody of your intellect give us that confidence. We'll be right back with more with the great George Friesley right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 81 years ago today, a hostile power executed with extreme stealth and deadly skill an attack that devastated the U.S. military in the Pacific and thrust this country into World War II. We are now at risk of an imminent and far more decisive reprise at the hands of a vastly more formidable adversary, the Chinese Communist Party. This danger looms at the moment, especially because the Biden administration is doing everything it can to invite the CCP's aggression. A commander-in-chief deeply compromised by our enemy has weakened and divided our country from the border to Washington, D.C. He's demoralized, distracted, and defanged our military, and he has basically done nothing to defend Taiwan. This is no drill. Will we swiftly act to make the costs of the next surprise attack intolerably high to the Chinese communists, or needlessly suffer them ourselves? This is Frank Gaffney. George Racy is in the house, I'm pleased to say, the executive editor of the wonderful Richard Viguerie newsletter, Conservative HQ. You can find it online. I really commend it to you. It's terrific, up-to-the-minute reporting on so much of what's going on, and good common sense, as I said, George, about this case before the Supreme Court. Why would you think that the conservatives on this court, five of whom have been pretty firm about original intent and the like, might not vote? As we speak, we haven't heard the kinds of questions that they're putting to the various parties in this case, so we can't judge on that basis, reading the tea leaves, as they say. But why is your instinct that they may not take the plain meaning of the Constitution at face value?
Well, we have Chief Justice Roberts, who is squishy on originalism, in the sense that if taking an originalist view of the Constitution makes a major change in how business is being conducted in the country, Roberts is always reluctant to do it. So
we have four originalists and one sometime.
Yeah. And Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett have had more of a tendency to follow Roberts than not. And so he could easily peel off, one or both of them.
Well, this would be disheartening in the extreme. And what would the implications be? I mean, it would be jump ball in every state from this point forward?
What it would do is it would empower federal judges and state Supreme Courts to overturn state election laws, in essence, at their whim. And so we would go back to the situation that we had on so many other issues, where judges would be acting like a super legislature and making the rules rather than having the people's representatives make the rules.
Yeah, this would be, I would argue, the end of free and fair elections, finally. George, let me talk to you about the practical effects of the Warnock victory in the United States Senate. We'll come to the lame duck session in a moment, but just looking forward to the next Congress, where it's not a 50-50 split with the vice president casting the deciding vote a lot, but actual 51 Democratic senators. What are the likely repercussions of that, as you see it?
Well, it ends the power-sharing agreement that they have now, where they have equal representation on all the committees. And so that the, pardon me, the crucial vote is always on the floor. Now, it only takes a majority. They can, with 50 votes or 51 votes, do away with the filibuster on certain pieces of legislation, or do away with it entirely, as something that Schumer has threatened, by the way. And his comment, I think late last night or early this morning, was, well, now you're going to see what Democrats really stand for, which should scare us all.
God help us. Yeah. It's been chilling enough to see what we've seen so far, yeah. Let alone an agenda that may include, in addition to ending the filibuster, admitting new states to the union with permanent Democratic representation,
yeah,
almost certainly, and packing the Supreme Court too.
It could do, and certainly what it's going to do is put a tremendous amount of pressure on Kevin McCarthy or whoever leads the Republicans in the House, because all the social agenda issues that you know, the House is expected to be the backstop on would you know, come through the Senate. You name it. Well, they already did gay marriage, so that one's out. But, you know, universal abortion, you know, pick your poison on the far left agenda, and it can now pass.
Election law, among other things.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah. It could pass, especially if Republicans do what Republicans want to do and Democrats almost never do, which is to say, fracture and vote in a majority for some of these culture war issues. George, before we run out of time, that's a chilling prognosis. We've had a very interesting development with Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter, and I wanted to ask you about the political implications of this. He has revealed, as you know, in a number of internal documents of the company he's just acquired, evidence that there was very active and longstanding collusion between the Biden campaign, the Democratic Party, the mainstream media, as well as social media, at least Twitter, and we assume the others, with the FBI and perhaps others in the U.S. government to essentially exercise censorship to the benefit of one of the political parties, namely the Democrats, namely specifically Joe Biden's candidacy in 2020. Yeah. This is not exactly a surprise given what we've known to date, but it does seem as though we finally have the smoking gun. I'm struck by the fact, as you may have seen, Tucker Carlson has released last night, and I guess in the course of the day today, we'll release the second of the two sections of a documentary that's a very powerful portrayal of the degree of Joe Biden's collusion with another party, namely the Chinese Communist Party, all of which suggests that if there is a House of Representatives that's going to have any real Republican, you know, fortitude, not, you know, sort of controlled opposition, but a real robust opposition, will be the focus of serious investigations. But talk us through how you see this and where we go from here.
Well, I think the interesting thing, Frank, is that a great deal of what Twitter did was not instigated by a third party. It was the high-level Democrat far-left operatives at the senior level of the company making these decisions because they wanted to use their company assets to advance the far-left agenda. And so this, you know, Twitter under the previous ownership and all these social media companies, you know, they get some cues or some requests from the FBI or Department of Homeland Security or whatever. But in a lot of this, they're freelancing because they already know what to do.
They don't need to be told.
They don't need to be told. They're using the shareholders' assets to advance the far left agenda. And to the extent that this is happening, not just at Twitter, but at other social media companies, and I would argue at other major corporations, they are, in essence, all political players. And there is, as good Marxists always do, everything's about politics and so and power. And so the Twitter executives, you know, would get a queue or a request from the FBI. They just run with it. I mean, they didn't need to say shadow ban CHQ's Twitter account. They already knew if it's conservative, shadow ban it or ban it outright.
but it does seem as though what we have now is indications that there was more direction as well.
Absolutely.
It may not have been needed, as you say, George, but it was forthcoming from the FBI, from DHS perhaps, and others to influence the election. This is illegal.
It's absolutely
and it has to be, I think, prosecuted as such. Yeah. Probably not by the Justice Department of Joe Biden, but by the United States Congress. We have to leave it at that. Okay. George Raceley, as always, such a fascinating set of insights into really important topics. Come back to us again with more soon, if you will. We'll be right back with more of this program right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. It's always a delight to say we are joined by James Roguski. He is an activist. He is a researcher. He is an author. And he is one of the guys who has doggedly been monitoring a development, I believe, of, well, surpassing importance. And yet it's not getting nearly the attention it deserves, other than from his hand and those who are informed by it. Namely, a threat to the sovereignty of our country and to the freedoms of its people emanating from an outfit that has arguably contributed to the loss of a million of Americans' lives in the recent unpleasantness known as the COVID-19 pandemic. Some of us call it the Wuhan virus, a biological warfare attack emanating from the Chinese Communist Party's Institute of Virology in Wuhan. James Roguski at Substack has been reporting very impressively about what's going on with this essential proxy of the Chinese Communist Party, Tedros Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, and what the Biden administration, among others, are trying to do to confer on Ghebreyesus and the World Health Organization still more power at our expense. James Roguski, welcome back to Securing America. It's always good to have you, my friend. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. I know time is limited. There's a lot to say. What would you like
Let's
to talk
right
about
to
first?
It. Yeah. Well, I know that you have been following closely a process of amending various documents, perhaps creating a new treaty with respect to the powers of the World Health Organization. But before we get to that, I thought we might just take a minute to talk about something that's already happened, and that was the G20 embracing the idea that the World Health Organization should create international vaccine passports, which will be required for people to travel outside their own country, and maybe in due course internally as well. What's gone on with that, James?
That's the abomination that much of the world is aware of. There's actually a second statement that was made by him later. I hope we get a chance to talk about that. That is very troubling as well. There are two tracks that they're talking about. One of the tracks is what people mentioned, what you said with the vaccine passport. They, in some sense, let the cat out of the bag, because what the Indonesian health minister, who's actually a banker, and that's a clue as to what's going on. It's not a doctor. He's a banker. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what he let out in public was that they were very proud that they had submitted a proposed amendments to what I now call the international surveillance regulations that used to be called in my, you know, in everyone else's world, the international health regulations. But when you read them, you realize they don't have anything to do about health. They're all about security and monitoring and reporting and all that sort of stuff. They want to have a digital global passport, basically to, you know, limit people's movements. And, you know, they literally said that if you get one of these passports, then you'll be able to move around. And so now is the time for, you know, Americans, but not just America, everyone in the world, because this is, you know, global, right, to just stand up against this and say, stop the WHO. And so, you know, everyone can also go to stopthewho.com.
Yeah.
This fits directly into the secret proposed amendments that have been put forth now by 16 different nations. So 16 nations are changing at least half of the existing international health regulations. And let me tell you, people, they are not about health. They are about surveillance and control. They had meetings all last week, completely in secret, with a group that's called the International Health Regulations Review Committee. And they very specifically are sworn to secrecy, and they answer only to Tedros.
So what could possibly go wrong, I guess, James, is the question that occurs. But let me just ask you to tease out what you said was the second agreement that we didn't
Absolutely.
Hear so much about.
That actually applies to the second track, where which is the proposed pandemic treaty. And so they're meeting literally, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday this week, 5, 6, and 7. And the latest article I wrote about that is that, you know, potentially these are 3 days that will live in infamy. We're recording this on the 81st anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And this is as big, you know, a threat to our existence, our sovereignty, our personal freedom. What they are trying to do in the pandemic treaty is bypass the financing that comes from, you know, individual nations. They've set up a financial intermediary fund. And the clip that most people have not seen, I have it on my Substacks, of the Indonesian health minister, who's really a banker. The United States and many other countries, as well as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Wellness Trust, the Rockefeller Foundation, they've set up a fund that ultimately they want it to be $10 billion a year, which is more than twice what the WHO's budget is already. So they want to greatly expand, you know, the money. And the minister said to his audience, I mean, it was essentially a business opportunity meeting. He literally said, you know, this is a great business opportunity. Start investing in the companies that manufacture pandemic response products. Now, that's medications, that's injections, I will not call them vaccines. That's, you know, personal protective equipment, testing, you know, PCR equipment, all that sort of stuff. This is a power grab and a money grab.
And again, James, the problem, it seems to me, is in the first instance, this is all being done in secret.
Absolutely.
And we're not allowed to know what kinds of compromises are being made. And then, as I understand it, even though they characterize the second of these two exercises as a treaty, that it's unlikely that it will be submitted to the United States Senate for its advice and consent, as treaties are obliged to be treated in our Constitution, making it unlikely that we'll have the opportunity for the rejection, ideally, of such a document, or even its significant amendment to protect our freedoms. Is that right?
Absolutely. The WHO had created a framework convention on tobacco control back in, I believe it was 2003, and President George W. Bush at the time signed it, never bothered to ask for the Senate's, you know, consent or even, you know, submitted it to him. And so the legal nature of how they're attempting to craft this is they want each nation, right, to give up some of their power, some of their sovereignty, and give up some of the individual freedoms. And they're creating an entirely new organization. If you're familiar with the climate change organization, they refer to it as the Conference of the Parties, or COP, you know, they just had their COP27. They're attempting to, or proposing anyways, to set up a similar structure. And they want to have, you know, the parties that, you know, sign on to the treaty. They want to have an extended conference of the parties, which are all of their cronies in all of the various non-governmental organizations, all of the foundations and the, they call them non-state actors, but they want it to be ruled over by a governing body that has two presidents and four vice presidents. Okay. And that's in Article 19 of the proposed treaty. You know, I realize that this is a lot of information and there's a lot going on. And I encourage everyone to just simply call me if they're interested. My phone number is 310-619-3055. All of this is on James Roguski, R-O-G-U-S-K-I, .substack.com. Now is the time to stop this freight train while it's still trying to get some traction going uphill. Once it gets rolling and, you know, they try to put it in place, it's going to be very, very difficult to stop. But yeah. They're trying to get their act together.
Let me make it clear what is at stake, as I see it, based on, among other things, what you've just said. The building block for all of this is this increasing digitalization,
yes,
of the personal information of individuals. And we've come to call this the digital gulag, which, when it is combined with the pandemic response that was essentially mandated by the World Health Organization at the direction of the Chinese Communist Party back in the COVID pandemic, and will become the template presumably going forward, especially if all of these interested parties, actors of the state and non-state kind, have their way. We'll find that digitization and the various modalities for tracking people and controlling people institutionalized in a way that will make what we've been through, even what I would argue the zero COVID lockdowns in China have entailed, seem like days at the beach. And this is very troubling, but we've got 30 seconds. What can people do now, aside from checking out your work?
Just realize that you have the inalienable right to privacy of your papers and your information, your health information, for sure. We are working on many things to reach out to Congress, which will be changing, you know, in January. There'll be slightly new Congress. Now is the time to get informed, spread the word, at the very least, take this video and share it with everyone you know.
Amen. Thanks, James Roguski, as always, for the great work you do at Substack and with us at programs like this. And thank you for giving out your phone number for people to follow it up.
I look forward to meeting half your audience.
Me too.
Wonderful people.
We'll be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. And a very special welcome to our next guest, a man I've come to admire greatly over the years for his courage, as well as his conviction, in standing up against those within his faith community, that would be the Muslim faith, who are seeking to invoke, among other things, the Quran and other sacred scripture to justify the conquest of the entire world, establishing a caliphate, and otherwise imposing the Islamic code of Sharia on everybody, Muslim and non-Muslim alike. He is a Muslim reformer, and I think a very formidable one at that. He understands better than most the challenges that we all face from what I call Sharia supremacists. He is an author of an important book on the subject, The Battle for the Soul of Islam. He is a medical doctor by training, served in the United States Navy in that role, among other places, in the United States Congress, as a matter of fact. And he is these days, in addition to practicing nuclear medicine doctor, a leader of the Muslim reform movement, and the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. His name is Dr. Zudi Jasser, and we're delighted to have him back with us. Dr. Jasser, welcome once again to Securing America.
Thanks. Thanks, Frank. It's great to be with you.
I wanted to sort of do some stock-taking. Zudi, you have, I think, been in the fight now for many years against these supremacists, notably of the Muslim Brotherhood stripe in our own country. You've also served on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and you've seen them at work elsewhere around the world. Give us a sense, if you would, Zudi, of the role the Brotherhood is now playing as an influence on and operating within the Biden administration.
Yeah, I have to tell you, Frank, it's even beyond simply calling it Obama 3.0. There is now, because of how influential the far left extreme progressivists have been in the Biden administration, that relationship they've long had domestically and globally in what we've all called the red-green axis has basically gone on steroids. And that red-green axis we see globally in the far left extremists working with the Islamists, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Islamists in Iran, the Islamists in the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, and even the radicals of Al-Qaeda and otherwise. So that's basically taken off. And, you know, in the Obama administration, I used to call it sort of the Darwinian foreign policy, where they just sort of let the powers that be, the jihadists in the Middle East and domestically take over. Now it's even beyond that. They're facilitating them and appointing them to positions that used to have some type of give and take of at least the conservatives and some of us. When I was on the U.S. Commission, as you mentioned, I used to at least balance some of the apologetics of the likes of James Ogilvie that was on USURF with me. They used to apologize for a lot of the regimes. Now you have basically one of the founding Islamist leaders in the U.S., Mohammed Majid, on the U.S. Commission. And what he does is it turns a blind eye of that commission from the influence of the quarter of the world's population, which are Muslim, being political Islam, turns a blind eye away from that and blames the West, blames Israel, and all these other conspiracy theories that are now, in the name of religious freedom, being co-opted into a different agenda, which is anti-American, anti-Semitic, and anti-freedom.
Mohammed Majid is a particularly problematic character because he not only runs a very large mosque complex in Northern Virginia, but he has really, as you say, insinuated himself into, well, not just the Biden administration and now an official capacity, but also into the sort of interfaith dialogue and sort of the community of people who are held up as leaders of the Muslim American community. And Zudi, I know you've, again, crossed swords with these guys, figuratively, for a long time. What does it say to Muslims who I have the feeling, on balance in this country, are a lot more like you than like the Muslim Brotherhood, that we're, you know, sort of legitimating folks like Majid and leaders of other Brotherhood Front organizations, for that matter, across this country, as the authoritative spokespeople for the Muslim American community?
Yeah, I have to tell you that, you know, back when I was appointed by Senator McConnell to the commission in 2012, you know, 100 plus mosques condemned my appointment, protested around his office and otherwise. And our response was, you know, listen, there's 2,400 mosques in America and 2,300 did not protest. And that doesn't make them moderate, but I'm just saying that at least the platform that these Islamists have is not as big as the Washington bubble would make it think. And even now, the Washington bubble of Biden and the progressivists, even though they're appointing more extreme appointees than they ever have before, ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, that used to have conventions of 30, 40,000 Muslims, now is barely having 5, 6,000, 10,000 show up. They're really bleeding in their support because of what we see happening in Iran, what we see happening around the world, which is the Islamists, the theocrats, are no longer able to convince Muslims that they are the answer to their problem, blaming everything on the West, on the Jews and other type of conspiracy theories, and anti-Semitism and hate is just not selling anymore. Now, does that mean we have a platform? Not necessarily. We still are working hard to try to get the fire under the feet of Muslims to not just be apathetic in America, but in Iran, I think you can see what the future holds for Muslim communities, which is, you know, they're on the verge of a revolution there. And it's slowly building where it's not just about women who don't want to wear hijab. The hijabis are actually marching against them, saying, don't force us to do anything. The computer workers, the engineers, the restaurants, the marketeers are all protesting against the theocrats, and their days are numbered. So the Biden administration is really out of touch. They're appointing people that are in the past, not in the future. And it's really, I think, eventually is going to be exposed, as we saw with a lot of the movement in American politics away from the Washington establishment. And that's why our Muslim reform movement is really an anti-establishment movement against those who've strangulated our community for so long.
Yeah, I commend you for making that effort. Needless to say, it's needed. And I think it is, as you say, part of a larger trend, and we should be encouraging it in Iran, of course, and elsewhere. We're going to talk a little bit more about another part of the Middle East that you know well and what we should be doing there with Dr. Zudi Jasser right after this. Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Dr. Zudi Jasser, a formidable medical practitioner, but also a formidable champion for freedom within the Muslim community, as well as America and around the world. And Zudi, you were talking about Iran. I would argue that it is in the middle of a revolution, not just a coming one, but it's clearly the case that people are sick of those who have been trying to impose, well, Sharia on their country for decades, and seeking to destroy others who have not submitted. I want to go to one of the neighboring countries, Syria, from whence your family hailed. Talk a little bit about what's going on there at the moment, with the regime on the one hand, with the Turks on another hand, with the Iranians on yet another hand, and of course, with those who aspire to freedom in Syria as well. And then there's always, I guess, what's left of the Islamic State. So it's a real witch's brew at the moment. Talk us through it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up because, you know, Frank, if any group of people ever got close to being as close an ally as Israel is to the United States, it's the Kurdish people. And the Kurds have basically been suffering at the hands of not only Saddam and Iraqi radicalism with the Iranian incursion into Iraq, but at the Assad regime and through the revolution in Syria and also in Turkey, for a long time they've been victims. And Erdogan is sort of a caliphate wannabe, not sort of, that's, he's openly said he wants to be sort of the leader of the future reawakening of the Ottoman Caliphate, and his party, the Freedom, Justice, and Development Party, is basically a template of the Muslim Brotherhood, Turkish version, if you will. And his alliances that he supported over the last 20 years have included radicalization of Hamas with direct funding of them, helping Iran bypass the sanctions. He's worked closely with Qatar on helping the Taliban and others. So this is an Islamist regime that has taken the opportunity of the West being asleep to incur the border into Syria, not necessarily. Actually, he's played a double game when it comes to Syria and Russia, where one week he's with Assad in Russia, the next week he's helping the Al-Qaeda, ISIS types. But at the end of the day, in the last few weeks, last few months, what's been happening is repeated bombing with missiles of the Kurdish community. Over hundreds of thousands have been displaced in the past year to two. And it's because the world is turning a blind eye to our only ally in the region that has protected Americans, that has never committed an act of terror but against Americans, and yet we've abandoned them. And Erdogan basically is using the blindness of the world right now as a mechanism to teach the Kurds a lesson, but also to empower ISIS. What happens right now, the only thing reigning in ISIS is not Assad, it's the Kurdish community there. And by bombing the Kurds, he's actually going to empower the Islamists, as he's done repeatedly in the region. And it breaks my heart to see that happening.
Well, he is an Islamist, of course, as you say. And the fact that he continues to be treated as though he is a reliable ally in NATO is crazy making, because among others, he's, of course, hooked up with both the Russians and the Chinese, deeply problematic power in the region, and I fear it's being mostly applied for ill intent. Zudi, I wanted to ask you one other question about a manifestation of this problem closer to home. As you know, the radical progressives, well, Marxists, I would call them, in the Biden administration have been doing something that, living in Arizona as you do, you know very well, has essentially eliminated the U.S. border with Mexico and has made it essentially a thoroughfare for people from all over the world coming here. And a fair number of them are coming from countries that I think Donald Trump properly said, you know, we should have real concerns about. They're bringing, in some cases, the traditions of Sharia and the jihad that it commands. And others are you know, active jihadis in their own right. We had Todd Bensman on the show yesterday, one of our duty experts with the Center for Immigration Studies on the border security and so on. And he had visited recently, I believe, a facility, I think sponsored by an NGO out of San Diego, in Tijuana, just across the border, like two blocks from the border in Mexico. That is an Islamic themed, I think, is the way he described it. It's got the trappings of, you know, the minaret and so on. But it has apparently inside, and he went inside and he interviewed a lot of those taking shelter there en route to our border, and discovered that many of them are coming from ominously problematic countries and are military age, unaccompanied young men. Is there any reason, based on your extensive experience with such folks, that we should be particularly concerned about the prospect that this shelter may be enabling large numbers of people who are coming here? And there are large numbers of people who are coming here with bad intent, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying that this particular facility may be aiding and abetting those of a jihadist mindset coming to our country. Should we be concerned?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is really close to my heart here, because I'm in Phoenix, where we're based, and we've been trying to educate the community about the importance of ideological vetting of people that are coming. And I can tell you, just ask the Germans and Italians and other in Europe, when they saw millions coming from Syria, statistics showed that conservatively 10% or 1 out of 10 had sympathy for ISIS that were in the Muslim community that came through. And actually more realistically, 20 to 25% had sympathies for ISIS. Probably 5 to 10% appreciated terrorism. So at the end of the day, this is not about religious freedom. People are welcome to come to America like my family did to practice their faith more freely. But, you know, while every Muslim is not an Islamist, every Islamist is a Muslim. So at the end of the day, the faith does matter when we're vetting people. And I've tried to get Congress. Maybe now it'll become our Congress will become a little more rational. We can have hearings about vetting people coming through the border. We didn't do that. They seem to not care about who's coming through. But the folks that want to come to America for political freedom through the front door, like the Iranian community is, many of them are, Syrian community, they're not coming through, most of the ones I know, through the border at the, you know, break of dawn when nobody can see them. They're coming through the right way, and they need to be vetted, and we're not doing that.
Amen. Zudi Jasser, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work you do with the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. I know you'll keep it up. I'm going to come back to us soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.